Many people, both non-Catholics and those who claim to be Catholic, think that St. Paul rebuked St. Peter in Galatians 2:11, where it is written, quote, "I opposed him to the face because he stood condemned," end quote.
It's a rather shocking passage. The Apostle Paul confronting the Apostle Peter to the face, opposing him because he was to be condemned. What is behind this confrontation?
This video will cover a variety of important issues and present an extremely strong argument that it was not St. Peter but a different person whom St. Paul rebuked for refusing to eat with Gentile converts to Christianity who did not observe the Mosaic Law, as recorded in Galatians chapter 2. This subject is very significant because many people have formed faulty theological conclusions based, at least in part, on the idea that St. Peter is referred to in Galatians 2, 11-14.
Paul opposes Peter right in front of everybody and says, "You are not walking straight in accordance to the truth of the gospel." Got it.
After the Council of Jerusalem in 49, Peter, Paul, and Barnabas go up to Antioch. And we see in Galatians 2, when Cephas came to Antioch, I confronted him to his face, for he was clearly wrong. Paul is not afraid of anybody, and he goes after Peter, something terrible.
Okay. Whereas here, he stands up to him in Antioch. He says, "But when he's in Antioch, I was stood in the face." That's why Paul has to rebuke him and correct him. Because Peter has come under this Judaizing effect here.
This is what we mean when we say we resist you to the face. It comes from Galatians. It comes from St. Paul honorably resisting Peter to his face rather than behind his back.
To understand this issue, first note that some English translations of Galatians 2:11 list the name of the person whom St. Paul rebuked as Cephas. Others give his name as Peter. Now, in John 1:42, we are told that the Greek name Petros, rendered in English as Peter, is a translation or interpretation of the name Cephas, which is rendered in English as Cephas. John 1:42, quote, "Looking directly at him, Jesus said, 'You are Simon, son of John. You will be called Cephas,' which is translated Peter," end quote. The name of the apostle in Greek, Petros, Peter in English, is, according to John 1:42, a translation or interpretation of the name Cephas. Cephas is rendered in English as Cephas, just as Petros is rendered in English as Peter. Petros is said to be a translation or interpretation of Cephas because Cephas comes from a different language, namely Aramaic. The name Cephas, which appears in the Greek text of John 1:42, is itself a transliteration, not a translation, of the Aramaic word kepha, which means rock. A translation is when a word in one language is given an equivalent meaning in a different language, such as kepha in Aramaic eventually becoming petros in Greek. A transliteration is when a word or name in one language is simply brought into a different language, but adjusted somewhat to make it look or sound like the other language. Thus, the Aramaic kepha, when transliterated into Greek, becomes kephas. And when kephas is transliterated into Latin and then into English, it becomes cephas. So, to put it simply, St. Peter's name Petros ultimately comes from the Aramaic word kepha, which means rock. The fact that John 1:42 connects Peter's name with an Aramaic word for rock is another proof that St. Peter was the rock upon which the Church of Christ would be built, as Matthew chapter 16 so clearly indicates. Jesus gave Peter a new name which means rock because Peter would be the rock upon which the church would be built. Now, to examine whether St. Peter is being referred to in Galatians 2:11-14, where St. Paul mentions the person he rebuked, we should first consider Galatians 2:7-14 as it appears in the Latin Vulgate. Then we will consider the Greek. I have read the whole New Testament in Latin according to the Clementine Latin Vulgate, and I have read the whole New Testament in Greek according to the Nestle-Aland 28th edition of the Greek New Testament. In Galatians 2:7, St. Paul says, quote, "But on the contrary, when they had seen that to me was committed the gospel of the uncircumcision, as to Peter, that of the circumcision," end quote. Here St. Paul is referring to the primary fields of activity in which he and St. Peter worked. There is no doubt that St. Paul is describing St. Peter in this verse. This is reflected in the Latin Vulgate by the word petro, a form of petrus. St. Peter was primarily preaching to and converting the Judeans, while St. Paul was primarily working among the Gentiles. This, of course, does not contradict St. Peter's universal authority over the church that includes both Judeans and Gentiles. St. Peter's universal authority is proven by Matthew 16, where St. Peter is promised the keys to the kingdom, by Luke 22, where St. Peter, alone among the apostles, is promised an unfailing faith, and by John 21:15-17, where St. Peter, again alone among the apostles, is entrusted with the entire flock by Christ. St. Peter's leadership of the entire church is also evident from the singularity and the prominence he is given in the Gospels and in the Acts of the Apostles. When Peter is mentioned by name, the other apostles are frequently described as those with Peter. For example, Acts 2:37, Peter and the rest of the apostles. Acts 5:29, Peter and the other apostles. Mark 1:36, Simon and those who were with him. Luke 9:32, Peter and those who were with him. With regard to the 12 apostles, St. Peter's name is also mentioned more frequently than all of the other apostles combined. Further, when the names of the 12 apostles are listed, Peter's name is always first and Judas's name is last. Peter leads the church in replacing Judas in Acts chapter 1. Peter speaks for the church at Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. Peter works the first miraculous healing in post-ascension church history in Acts chapter 3. Peter answers for the church before the council of the high priest in Acts chapter 4. Peter meets out the discipline to Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5, and more. In Matthew 10, when the names of the 12 are given, Peter is not simply listed first, but called protos, meaning first, chief, or principal. This description in Matthew 10:2 is often overlooked, but it is very significant. Since no other numbers are given in the list of Matthew 10, and Peter was not the first one who followed Jesus, Andrew was, the declaration that he is protos is not meant to indicate chronologically first, but rather first in importance and rank. It is to indicate that he is the chief, leader, or principal of the 12. Matthew is literally saying, quote, in first position, Simon, who is called Peter, end quote. This is a clear proof of St. Peter's primacy. St. Peter's leadership over the Gentiles is also demonstrated by Acts chapter 10, where St. Peter alone is given the profound vision signifying the old law's restrictions against unclean foods had ended, the vision that would shape all future church history. God gave the vision to St. Peter because he was the leader of the church, and when he started to incorporate the Gentiles, the church would follow his example. Hence, the first Gentile convert, Cornelius, was told to find St. Peter, the leader of the church. Concerning his unique role in the incorporation of the Gentiles, Acts 15:7 says this about St. Peter's actions at the Council of Jerusalem, quote, and after there had been much debate, Peter stood up and said to them, brothers, you know that in the early days God chose from among you that by my mouth the Gentiles should hear the word of the gospel and believe, end quote. As the visible head of the church, Peter spoke first and pronounced the definitive doctrinal decision at the council. And contrary to what some say, it was Peter, not James, who made the decisive doctrinal statement at the council. Peter proclaimed that Gentile converts do not need to be burdened with the yoke of circumcision and all the requirements of the old law. Peter said, quote, and he made no distinction between us and them, having cleansed their hearts by faith. Now therefore, why are you putting God to the test by placing a yoke on the neck of the disciples that neither our fathers nor we have been able to bear? But through the grace of the Lord Jesus, we believe them also to be saved in the same manner, end quote. When Peter ended his speech in Acts 15:11, the very next verse, Acts 15:12, says, quote, then all the multitude kept silence and gave audience to Barnabas and Paul, end quote. Scripture mentions the silence immediately after Peter's words finish. This indicates that the multitude recognized the authority of St. Peter's decision and position. As non-Catholic commentator on Acts, Daryl L. Bach admitted, quote, the assembly became silent as a result of Peter's remarks, end quote. The particular proposal made by James, the local bishop of Jerusalem, that Gentile converts should abstain from food that has been sacrificed to idols, from blood, and from what has been strangled, which the apostles decided to adopt, was a recommendation involving church discipline, not dogma. It was a disciplinary measure adopted by the church for that particular apostolic period in which a single church of Christ was forming from those who had observed the old law and Gentiles who had not. However, it did not bind for all of church history, unlike Peter's dogmatic declaration about incorporating Gentiles into the church. Thus, Peter proclaimed the key doctrinal truth that would stand for all of church history, not James. In fact, in the first part of James' speech, he makes reference to what Simon Peter had already said. Acts 15:14, James said, quote, Simeon has expounded how God first visited to take from the Gentiles a people for his name, end quote. Using the Hebrew form of Simon, Simeon, James refers to St. Peter's speech near the beginning of his speech. Yet when Peter began to speak, he didn't reference any other man. He simply mentioned how God chose him. Further, when James says Simeon expounded, the word used in Greek is exegesata, a form of the verb exegeamai. The verb can mean to expound or relate, and it was often used in antiquity for purporting to reveal divine things. In fact, each time the verb is used in the New Testament, it refers to those who are reporting acts or statements of God or heaven. The term exegesis, exegesis in Greek, derives from the verb exegeemai. Thus, one could translate Acts 15:14 as, quote, Simeon has exegeted how God first visited to take from the Gentiles a people for his name, end quote. A Protestant commentator named Adolf Schlatter noted that Josephus, the ancient historian, used the verb as a technical term for the interpretation of the law as practiced by the rabbinate. The New Testament uses the verb 6 times, including for how Cornelius made the angel's message known, and for how Paul and Barnabas, after Peter's speech at the council, related God's miracles in Acts 15:12. So, when James references Peter's speech near the beginning of his speech, he describes Peter's statement as an exegesis of God's revelation on the Gentile issue. That exegesis of Peter came first at the council after Peter stood up, and it silenced the assembly. It should also be noted that Peter, as the leader of the church, presided over the Jerusalem congregation and the rest of the church after the ascension. Thus, in Acts 1:15, we see Peter's leadership role when the church was gathered in Jerusalem to replace Judas. Later on in the book of Acts, however, Peter sometimes departed from Jerusalem and went here and there on missionary excursions. See Acts 9:32. Since Peter was periodically absent from Jerusalem for such endeavors, and he was even imprisoned in Acts 12, James was put in charge of the local church in Jerusalem. As Jerusalem's local bishop, James naturally played a key role both in the church in Jerusalem and at the Council of Jerusalem. However, Peter remained the leader of the universal church by the institution of Christ. Hence, Peter spoke first at the council and proclaimed the key doctrinal truth that silenced the assembly. Moreover, as our video The Bible Proves the Papacy showed, the description of St. Peter's actions at the Council of Jerusalem in Acts 15 is strikingly parallel to the description of King David's actions at an Old Testament assembly or council in Jerusalem recorded in 1 Chronicles 28. The parallel supports the fact that Peter was the first pope. The assembly or council in Jerusalem recorded in 1 Chronicles 28 met in order to discuss how to build the temple or house of God. It was therefore a type or symbol of the future council in Acts 15, which met to discuss how God's temple, that is, the New Testament church, would be built or expanded going forward. 1 Chronicles 28 tells us that all the chief men of Israel were assembled at Jerusalem for this event. Likewise, at the Acts 15 council, the apostles and elders were gathered in Jerusalem. Well, both David and St. Peter stand up at these councils in Jerusalem, and they use strikingly similar language to describe their unique God-appointed roles. In 1 Chronicles 28:2, we read that David stood up in the midst of the assembly. In Acts 15:7, we read that, and after there had been much debate, Peter stood up and addressed them. In 1 Chronicles 28:4, we read that David said, Yet the Lord God of Israel chose me out of the whole house of my father to be king over Israel forever. In Acts 15:7, we read that St. Peter said, Brothers, you know that in the early days God chose from among you, that by my mouth the Gentiles should hear the word of the gospel and believe. The parallel is stunning and clear. David stands up at the council in Jerusalem and says that God chose me, just as Peter stands up at the council in Jerusalem and says that God chose my mouth. Because God chose King David to have supreme authority over Old Testament Israel, just as he chose Peter to have supreme authority over the new Israel, the church. In fact, the Greek word for chose in Acts 15:7, when Peter says, God chose my mouth, is ex alexata. That's the exact same word that we find in the Greek translation of 1 Chronicles 28:4, the Septuagint, when King David said, God chose me to be king. And just as the office of King David had successors, the office of St. Peter does as well. So, having recapped St. Peter's universal authority over both Judeans and Gentiles in the church, let's move back to Galatians chapter 2. We saw that in Galatians 2:7, St. Paul definitely refers to St. Peter. Likewise, in Galatians 2:8, we read, quote, For he who worked in Peter for the apostolate of the circumcision worked also in me among the Gentiles, end quote. This verse also undoubtedly refers to St. Peter. That's why we find Petro in the Latin Vulgate for this verse. However, when we move to the next verse, Galatians 2:9, this is where things start to become more involved. Galatians 2:9, quote, And when James and Cephas and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that was given to me, they gave the right hand of fellowship to Barnabas and me, that we should go to the Gentiles, and they to the circumcised. End quote. Notice the shift in name from Peter to Cephas. The previous verses, Galatians 2:7 and Galatians 2:8, undoubtedly referred to St. Peter. In the Latin Vulgate for those verses, we see Petro, a form of Petrus. But in this verse, we see a switch in name. In Galatians 2:9, the Latin Vulgate doesn't have the name Petrus or any form of it, but rather the name Cephas. That name is pronounced Cephas in English, but in ecclesiastical Latin it is pronounced Cephas, even though it's spelled the same way. And as we continue to Galatians 2:11, a pivotal verse in this matter, we also find that the name of the person St. Paul rebukes is given as Cephas, not Peter. Galatians 2:11, quote, "But when Cephas had come to Antioch, I withstood him to the face because he was blameworthy," end quote. In the Latin Vulgate for this verse, we don't find Petrus or any form of it, but rather the name Cephas. And as we continue to Galatians 2:14, another key verse in this matter of the person St. Paul rebuked, we see the same thing. The name of the person is Cephas, not Peter. Quote, "But when I saw that they walked not uprightly unto the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas before them all, If you, being a Judean, live after the manner of the Gentiles, and not as the Judeans do, how do you compel the Gentiles to live as the Judeans?" End quote. Just like in Galatians 2:11, the Latin Vulgate for this verse, that is Galatians 2:14, does not have the name Petrus or any form of it, but rather Cephe, a form of Cephas. In Latin and Greek, the ending of a noun can change depending upon the role the word plays in a sentence, such as when it's the subject of the sentence, the direct object, the indirect object, etc. Thus, Cephas becomes Cephe in this instance. But even if the ending or form of a noun changes because of the role it plays in the sentence, it's the same word in both cases. Cephas and Cephe are different forms of the very same word. Likewise, Petrus and Petro are different forms of the very same word. But note well, Cephas slash Cephe is not the same word as Petrus slash Petro. They are different words. Likewise, in English, Peter is not the same word as Cephas. They are different words. Likewise, in Greek, Petros is not the same word as Cephas. They are different words, even though Petros is a translation of Cephas. So if someone is writing in one language, whether in Greek, Latin, or English, and he refers to Peter, and then he refers to Cephas, he's using two different words, not two forms of the same word. Now, we've already shown that the name Peter, Petros in Greek, comes from Cephas, but why would St. Paul twice refer to the man as Peter in Galatians 2:7-8, and then suddenly start calling him Cephas in Galatians 2:9-14? It doesn't make sense that he would do such a thing. What does make sense, however, is that St. Paul wasn't referring to St. Peter at all in Galatians 2:11 and Galatians 2:14 when he described the person he rebuked for refusing to eat with Gentiles who did not observe the Mosaic law, but rather that he was referring to an entirely different person who had the same Aramaic name as Peter. The sudden shift in reference from Peter in Galatians 2:7-8 to Cephas in Galatians 2:9-14 by itself constitutes a very strong argument that two different people are referred to in this context. So, was there another Cephas to whom St. Paul could have been referring in Galatians 2:9-14? According to evidence from the early church, the answer is yes. Before we get to that, note that many Greek manuscripts display the same curious shift in reference from Petros in Galatians 2:7-8 to Cephas in Galatians 2:9-14. By the way, some might ask if it's permitted for a Catholic who is engaged in responsible biblical studies to take into account original language manuscripts, textual variants, etc., if the Church hasn't specifically ruled on a particular text. The answer is yes. On that point, see Pope Pius XII's 1943 encyclical on biblical studies, Divino Afflante Spiritu. Now, on the matter of Galatians 2:7-8, the textual evidence in Greek manuscripts is overwhelming. Galatians 2:7-8 undoubtedly refers to St. Peter, hence we find the name Petros, or a form of it, in the Greek manuscripts for those verses. But when we move to Galatians 2:9-14, just as we saw in the Latin Vulgate, many Greek manuscripts reflect the same curious shift from Petros to Cephas. For instance, Greek manuscripts that contain Cephas and not Petros in Galatians 2:11, where St. Paul says, "I opposed him to the face because he stood condemned," include Codex Sinaiticus, Codex Alexandrinus, Codex Vaticanus, Codex Ephraemi, and numerous minuscules. Something persuaded those scribes to include the name Cephas, not Petros, when referring to the person St. Paul rebuked, even though in Galatians 2:7-8, where St. Paul speaks of Peter's apostolate, manuscripts such as Alexandrinus, Vaticanus, Ephraemi, and others have Petros, not Cephas. Why the shift in name? Again, we believe it's because St. Paul was referring to Peter in Galatians 2:7-8, but to an entirely different person named Cephas in Galatians 2:11-14. Now, there are Greek manuscripts that have the name Petros or a form of it in Galatians 2:11-14, but the argument is extremely strong that Cephas is the proper reading for Galatians 2:11-14, and that the appearance of Petros in Galatians 2:11-14 in some Greek manuscripts resulted from the error of copyists, who wrongly assumed that Cephas in Galatians 2 was Petros. And if we refer to an error in certain manuscripts, we of course are not attributing any error to the autographs or the original writings of the Bible, which were inspired by God and without error. But in the process of hand-copying parts of the Bible over time in many places, certain errors were made in some manuscript copies, and that's how textual variants arose. The important Greek manuscripts that contain, we believe correctly, Cephas and not Petros in Galatians 2:11-14 also agree with the Latin Vulgate on this point, as we've seen. Based on the various factors and evidence, we believe that Cephas, not Petros, is the proper reading for Galatians 2:11-14. An interesting example in this regard is P46 or Papyrus 46. It is one of the oldest existing New Testament manuscripts in Greek, with a probable date of AD 175 to AD 225. This is not to suggest that P46 is definitive or perfect, but that it's important to consider. It is fragmentary, it doesn't have Galatians 2:11, but it does have, among other things, Galatians 2:7-9 and Galatians 2:14. In P46, for Galatians 2:7 we find Petros, the nominative form of the name, and for Galatians 2:8 we find Petro, the dative form of the same name, Petros, just as the rest of the Greek manuscript tradition overwhelmingly confirms. But in Galatians 2:14, where St. Paul says, quote, "But when I saw that they walked not uprightly unto the truth of the gospel," P46 doesn't have the name Petros at all, but Kepha, the dative form of Kephas. And thus, according to it, the name of the person St. Paul rebuked in Galatians 2:14 was Cephas. "I said to Cephas before them all." Again, why does it have Petros and Petro in Galatians 2:7-8, but Kepha in Galatians 2:14? The answer, we believe, is that St. Paul was referring to two different people. Now, a few people who believe that Peter and Cephas in Galatians 2 are the same person, a position we believe is incorrect, argue that the shift in the text from Peter to Cephas is comparable to how the Lord is called Jesus in one verse, but Christ in another, or how Peter might be called Simon in one verse, but Peter in another. That argument is extremely weak, and we don't believe the comparison works. That's because Peter was known to be Simon Peter, and the Lord is known to be Jesus Christ, but Peter is not called Cephas Peter. Rather, Peter is a translation of Cephas. Further, and this is very important, St. Paul says nothing in this context to indicate that the person mentioned in Galatians 2:7-8 is the same person who is mentioned in Galatians 2:11-14. In fact, besides the switch in name, which strongly favors the position that Cephas in Galatians 2 is not Peter, the context and St. Paul's description suggest that two different people are in view. We believe that the only reason many people have concluded, in our view erroneously, that in Galatians 2 Petros and Cephas are the same person is because they were using an inaccurate manuscript or translation that substituted the name Peter for Cephas, or they were applying what is stated in John 1:42, that the name Petros is a translation of the name Cephas, to their reading of the chapter. But that reasoning is flawed because the original readers of Galatians would almost certainly not have had a copy of John's Gospel. And if they only knew Greek, they would not know that Petros is a translation of Cephas, unless they were informed of that fact. For example, in the following clip, notice that the speaker feels the need to, quote, help his listeners understand that in his view, Cephas in this chapter equals Peter, which they would not necessarily otherwise conclude.
Galatians 2:11-13. But when Cephas, that is the Aramaic word for Peter, Peter is the Greek word, Cephas is the Aramaic, when Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face.
As Protestant scholar D.A. Carson points out concerning readers of John's Gospel, and the point of course applies to many readers of other New Testament books, quote, because most of his, that is St. John's readers, cannot be expected to know any Semitic language, John provides the translation of Cephas, Peter, end quote. In other words, if they did not know Aramaic or had not been informed of the connection between Petros and Cephas, they would only know St. Peter as Petros, Peter, or perhaps as Simon, Simon, but not as Cephas. Anyone who carefully reads Galatians 2, according to what we believe the aforementioned proper readings are, should see that there's something quite odd in the way that St. Paul repeatedly refers to Peter, and then suddenly and repeatedly refers to Cephas, unless, as we believe, he was referring to two different people. Indeed, in Matthew's Gospel, which includes the profound statement about St. Peter, the significance of his name, and what he has promised in Matthew 16, we find no reference at all to Cephas, but only to Petros. Thus, if Greek-only readers of St. Paul's epistle to the Galatians saw references to Petros in Galatians 2:7-8, and then references to Cephas in Galatians 2:11-14, unless otherwise informed, they would have no reason not to think that they are two different people. So, was there another person to whom St. Paul could have been referring in Galatians 2:11-14? According to the evidence from the early church, the answer is yes. Early church historian Eusebius cites early church Father Clement of Alexandria, who stated that the person mentioned in Galatians 2:11 was not St. Peter, but one of the 70 disciples of the Lord mentioned in Luke chapter 10, who had the same name. Quote, Clement, in the fifth book of his Hypotyposes, in which he also mentions Cephas, of whom Paul writes, when he came to Antioch, I withstood him to his face, says that one who happened to have the same name as Peter the Apostle was one of the 70. End quote. So, according to Clement of Alexandria, who is quoted by Eusebius, the historian of the ancient church, the Cephas rebuked by St. Paul, as recorded in Galatians 2:11, was not the Apostle Peter, but a different person. This is very strong evidence that there was another person with the name Cephas, who was a somewhat prominent figure in the church, to whom St. Paul could have been referring in Galatians 2:11-14. By the way, in his 1893 encyclical Providentissimus Deus, when discussing fathers of the church and/or important writers from the period of the early church, Pope Leo XIII mentions Clement of Alexandria and refers to him in a positive fashion. The words of St. Jerome are also relevant in this regard. Even though St. Jerome held, we believe incorrectly, that Cephas of Galatians 2 was St. Peter, he acknowledged that others in the period of the early church believed that the Cephas of Galatians 2 was not St. Peter. Quote, there are those who think that Cephas, whom Paul here writes that he resisted to the face, was not the Apostle Peter, but another of the 70 disciples, so-called, and they allege that Peter could not have withdrawn himself from eating with the Gentiles, for he had baptized Cornelius the centurion, especially as St. Luke nor even says that Peter was at Antioch with Paul. End quote. As we can see, various sources from the period of the early church provide evidence that there was another person named Cephas to whom St. Paul could have been referring in Galatians 2:11-14. Combined with the textual evidence about the shift in name, this makes the argument that St. Paul did not rebuke St. Peter in Galatians 2 very strong. The strength of this argument will only increase when we examine the relevant chronology. It should also be noted that enemies of the church have frequently referenced St. Paul's alleged rebuke of St. Peter in an attempt to discredit true Christianity. Enemies of the papacy, including many Protestants, have of course on many occasions attempted to justify their heretical and unbiblical rejection of the papacy by an appeal to St. Paul's alleged rebuke of St. Peter. But they are not the only opponents of Christianity to have brought it up. There was the non-Christian philosopher named Porphyry of Tyre, who died in the year 305. He put out a multi-book work against Christianity. St. Jerome notes that he referenced the alleged rebuke of St. Peter by St. Paul in Galatians 2 to accuse Christianity of having a false and contradictory doctrine. The notion that St. Peter, well after the resurrection, after having incorporated Cornelius, after having stood up to the Judaizers, etc., would have given occasion for such a rebuke is so unexpected that Origen, Jerome, and John Chrysostom thought that Peter and Paul simulated/acted out this event to make a point to the Judaizers. There's no reason to take such a view. A much simpler explanation, one well supported by the evidence, is that the Cephas of Galatians 2 was not St. Peter. What makes it even more implausible that St. Peter is the Cephas of Galatians 2 is the data in Acts chapter 11. It tells us that after the baptism of Cornelius and his Gentile companions, St. Peter went up to Jerusalem to report their conversion. He was then criticized by those of the circumcision for having eaten with the Gentiles. Quote, you went to uncircumcised men and ate with them, Acts 11:3. The accusation is basically identical to how the Judaizers in Galatians 2:11-14 would have felt and acted. Cephas in Galatians 2:11-14 was influenced and swayed by those Judaizers, and he was rebuked by St. Paul for it. But does Scripture tell us that St. Peter acted in a similar way in Acts 11? No, just the opposite. Peter defended his actions before those of the circumcision by referencing what the Spirit told him, And we read that, quote, when they, that is those of the circumcision, heard these things, they fell silent, and they glorified God, end quote, Acts 11:18. So in Acts 11, those of the circumcision changed their view based on what St. Peter said and did, not the other way around. But in Galatians 2:11-14, we read that Cephas changed his behavior to conform to those of the circumcision. Thus, the behavior attributed to Cephas in Galatians 2:11-14 is not at all consistent with the portrayal of St. Peter in the Acts of the Apostles, and it's specious to cite Peter's denial of Christ prior to the crucifixion in this regard. That was before the resurrection, before Jesus entrusted the flock to St. Peter, and before the apostles received the Holy Spirit in the manner they did after the resurrection. Indeed, as Vatican I declared, St. Peter did not become the pope until after the resurrection. Jesus' words in Matthew 16 were a promise about what he would confer upon St. Peter in the future, that is, after the resurrection, and it happened during the event recorded in John 21:15-17, when Jesus gave St. Peter authority over his entire flock and commanded him to tend or rule it. Further, Galatians 2:12 tells us that the Cephas mentioned in Galatians 2 fell into his fault because, quote, certain men came from James. Consider how unlikely it is that the chief apostle, St. Peter, after the resurrection, after having received the Holy Spirit, would have been swayed in this regard by certain men from James, who apparently were not even significant enough in the leadership of the early church to be mentioned by name. In the Acts, we see that St. Peter preached boldly to the Judeans and did not compromise at all. The vision given to St. Peter, his statements and his actions were an example for the entire church. At the Council of Jerusalem, he was accorded so much respect by the elders and the apostles that he spoke first. His speech silenced the multitude, and he referenced God's choice of his mouth to preach to the Gentiles. But supposedly the same man, accorded such a unique respect by the apostles and elders, who told the entire leadership of the church what they should think on the matter, became so concerned about certain men from James that he failed to display what he had previously displayed in Acts 10 at the command of God. That is, to make no distinction between the Judeans and Gentiles. It's not likely. Now let's consider some additional interesting aspects of this issue and address a few objections. Some might argue that in Galatians 1:18-19, St. Paul refers to St. Peter yet calls him Kephon, the accusative form of Kephas. This would support the view, so the argument goes, that Kephas in Galatians 2:9-14 is St. Peter. Galatians 1:18-19, quote, then after 3 years I went up to Jerusalem to become acquainted with Cephas and remained with him 15 days. But I saw none of the other apostles except James the Lord's brother, end quote. There are two problems with this argument. First, there's a textual variant in Galatians 1:18. Some manuscripts of Galatians 1:18 read Kephon, the accusative form of Kephas, but many others, and actually the majority, have Petron, the accusative form of Petros. The majority text is not always the correct reading, but in some cases it is. Here are some of the symbols of notable Greek manuscripts that contain Petron, not Kephon, in Galatians 1:18. The Latin Vulgate, supported by the entire Latin tradition, also has the name Peter, not Cephas, in Galatians 1:18. Thus, according to the manuscripts which contain Petron and not Kephon in Galatians 1:18-19, it would read, quote, then after 3 years I went up to Jerusalem to become acquainted with Peter and remained with him 15 days, but I saw none of the other apostles except James the Lord's brother, end quote. By the way, the word brother doesn't necessarily mean sibling. It doesn't mean that here, for Mary had no other children besides Jesus. Brother can simply mean a near relative and other things. If Petron is taken as the correct reading, then obviously that's perfectly consistent with the points we have covered. But even if someone holds that Kephon is the original reading of Galatians 1:18, and that the majority of all Greek manuscripts and the Vulgate have it wrong, that also would not disprove anything we have presented. That's because the New Testament sometimes uses the word apostle in reference to those who were not of the original 12. See Acts 14:14, where Barnabas is referred to as an apostle, even though he was not of the original 12. So, if Paul referred to Cephas as an apostle, that would not necessarily prove that Cephas was one of the original 12. However, if Paul is referring to the 12 apostles in Galatians 1:18-19, we contend that the proper reading is Petron, as can be seen in the majority of the manuscripts and supported by the Vulgate. This makes sense contextually as well, for in that case St. Paul would have mentioned Peter by name for the first time in Galatians 1:18 and proceeded to refer to him in a positive way in Galatians 2:7-8. And then in Galatians 2:9 he would have introduced by name Cephas, whom we contend was a different person, and proceeded to discuss him in more detail in Galatians 2:11-14. Thus, Galatians 1:18 does not contradict any of the points we have covered. The chronology strongly supports the position that Cephas of Galatians 2 is not Peter. St. Paul's trips to Jerusalem and the relevant chronology are very important to consider in the matter we are discussing. I believe that an examination of the information we are given about those trips in Acts and Galatians strengthens the argument we have been discussing and makes it almost certain that Cephas in Galatians 2 is not Peter. Let's consider the key facts. First, we saw that Galatians 1:18 mentions St. Paul's first trip to Jerusalem 3 years after his conversion. Various commentators connect that first visit with what is recorded in Acts 9:26-30. There we read that sometime after St. Paul's conversion, when he came to Jerusalem, the disciples were afraid of him because he had persecuted the church. But Barnabas brought Paul to the apostles and explained to them how he had seen the Lord. Quote, "And when he had come to Jerusalem, he attempted to join the disciples, and they were all afraid of him, for they did not believe that he was a disciple. But Barnabas took him and brought him to the apostles and declared to them how on the road he had seen the Lord." End quote. Acts 9:26-30 and Galatians 1:18 most likely refer to the same event, namely to the first visit of St. Paul to Jerusalem 3 years after his conversion. But in Galatians 2:1-2, St. Paul mentions another trip to Jerusalem. This is St. Paul's second trip to Jerusalem after his conversion, according to the information we are given in Galatians. Galatians 2:1-2, quote, "Then after 14 years I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along with me. I went up because of a revelation, and I laid before them the gospel which I preach among the Gentiles, although privately to those who seemed to be something, lest perhaps I should be running, or had run, in vain." End quote. Consider a few things about this passage. First, it's debatable whether after 14 years means 14 years after his first visit or 14 years after his conversion. In any case, it was over a decade after the first trip recorded in Galatians 1:18. Second, notice that St. Paul went up to Jerusalem this time because of a revelation. This will become important. Third, note that he laid before those who seemed to be something or were of repute the gospel that he preached. This is another powerful refutation of the heresy of sola scriptura. St. Paul's words here prove that he did not practice sola scriptura. As non-Catholic scholar Douglas J. Moo was forced to admit concerning Galatians 2:2, quote, "He, Paul, does go to Jerusalem. He does present his gospel for evaluation by the leaders there, and he does express concern about their verdict." End quote. St. Paul did not examine scripture alone as his final authority to see if his gospel was sound. On the contrary, he presented his gospel to church figures in Jerusalem to make sure he was not running in vain. This supports Catholicism and refutes Protestantism. Now, it is this second trip to Jerusalem that St. Paul discusses between Galatians 2:1 and Galatians 2:10. St. Paul is still discussing what happened on that trip in Galatians 2:9 when he says, quote, "And when James and Cephas and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that was given to me, they gave the right hand of communion to Barnabas and me, that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised." End quote. On this second trip to Jerusalem, Paul meets with James, Cephas, and John, who gave the right hand of communion to him and Barnabas. As an interesting aside, the word translated right in this text, as in the right hand of communion, is the Greek word dexios. Dexios is plural in Galatians 2:9, meaning right hands, and it is combined in context with the word koinonios, meaning of communion, to convey the idea of the right hands or the right hand of communion. The word hand or hand is not in the Greek of Galatians 2:9, but it is translated here because it is implied by the use of the word right. In Greek, the right hand is frequently denoted by simply using the adjective right. Paul and Barnabas received the right hands, dexios, of communion. It is noteworthy that the very same word, dexios, in a singular form, is used with hand in Revelation 13:16, where the mark of the beast on the right hand or forehead is mentioned. I believe that the inspired use of dexios in Galatians 2:9 to signify a right hand or mark of ecclesiastical communion with the true church provides further insight into the meaning of the mark of the beast on the right hand in the book of Revelation. As we discuss elsewhere, in our view, the mark of the beast is not a physical mark, but a spiritual one. It is connected with a spiritual mark or sign of ecclesiastical communion with a counter-church in the end times. The fact that Scripture uses the same word, dexios, in the context of the right hand or mark of ecclesiastical communion with the true church supports that view. The mark of the beast on the right hand in Revelation 13 should obviously be contrasted with the right hand of communion with the true church described in Galatians 2:9. Now, Galatians 2:9 refers to James, Cephas, and John who gave Paul and Barnabas the right hand of communion. We've been presenting the case that the Cephas mentioned in Galatians 2 is not the Apostle Peter, but a different man. When this list of names, that is James, Cephas, and John, is considered, some might object that if one were to take Cephas here as Peter, this grouping would match the three disciples, Peter, James, and John, who were sometimes set apart by Jesus in the Gospels, such as at the Transfiguration. But such a conclusion is unwarranted because the James at the Transfiguration was the son of Zebedee, the brother of St. John the Apostle. He is sometimes called James the Greater. His death is recorded at the beginning of Acts 12 as a result of a persecution by Herod Agrippa I. See Acts 12:2. But there was another James mentioned in Acts 12 who is still living when James, the brother of St. John, is killed. The James who is still living in Acts 12:17, after James, the brother of St. John, was killed, is typically considered to be the James who was the Bishop of Jerusalem. Some people identify the James of Acts 12:17 and the James who was the Bishop of Jerusalem as James the son of Alphaeus, that is, the other James among the 12 apostles, but some identify him as a third James who is often referred to as James the Just. Whatever position one takes on that point, there is a clear distinction between James the Greater, the brother of St. John, whose death is recorded in Acts 12:2, and the James who is still alive in Acts 12:17. The death of James the Greater, Acts 12:2, the brother of St. John, is solidly dated to around AD 43 or AD 44, based on the fact that Herod Agrippa I's death is dated to AD 44. Well, even an earlier dating of St. Paul's second trip to Jerusalem, the one recorded in Galatians 2:1-10, where he met with James, Cephas, and John, would be about AD 45, with some putting the trip around AD 48. So, just as the Cephas could have been, and we believe was, a different person from Peter, the James mentioned here was almost certainly not James the Greater, the brother of St. John. Further, besides the Apostle John, there was John Mark, whom Paul knew. John, whose other name was Mark, is mentioned repeatedly in the Acts of the Apostles, Acts 12:12, Acts 12:25, etc. That's an example of how more than one person bore the name John. Hence, there's nothing in the list of these three names that calls for the conclusion that Cephas was Peter, or that James was the son of Zebedee, the brother of St. John, or that John in this verse was necessarily the Apostle John. Indeed, in addition to all of the other evidence, contextual indications in this very chapter support the position that the Cephas mentioned in this verse is not Peter. James, Cephas, and John, the three mentioned in Galatians 2:9, could have been three somewhat important figures or missionaries who gave the right hand of communion to Paul and Barnabas. That might be why Paul says they seem to be or were reputed to be pillars. The word pillar in Galatians 2:9 is also found in Revelation 3:12, where it says to the church of Philadelphia, quote, "The one who conquers, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God," end quote. This statement about becoming a pillar applies to more than just the 12 apostles. Thus, the New Testament does not restrict the use of the word pillar to members of the original 12 apostles. Also, keep in mind that Paul's references to Peter in Galatians 2:7-8 do not claim that he met with Peter on this second trip to Jerusalem. Rather, he simply makes references to Peter's missionary apostolate when describing his own encounter with those who seemed to be something, namely James, Cephas, and John. Indeed, the contrast between how Paul describes Peter in this chapter and how he refers to those who seemed to be, such as Cephas, also supports the view that Cephas in Galatians 2 is not Peter. For instance, we saw that in Galatians 2:9, Paul says that James, Cephas, and John were those who seemed to be pillars. Paul first makes reference to that group using a similar description in Galatians 2:2 and Galatians 2:6. He describes them as those who seemed to be, or those who seemed to be something, but he doesn't mention them by name in either verse. His descriptions of them are somewhat distant and impersonal. He doesn't give the names of the full group until Galatians 2:9. Yet contrast that with how, in this very chapter and context, Paul twice refers to Peter in a direct, personal, familiar, and positive way in Galatians 2:7-8, using his name and noting that God worked through him. Contextually, this favors the position that Cephas in Galatians 2 was not Peter. Moreover, in Galatians 2:6, referring to those who seemed to be something, whom we learn in Galatians 2:9 included Cephas, Paul says, quote, "What they were at one time makes no difference to me," end quote. It makes no sense that Paul would make this statement about Peter, not only when we consider Peter's position, but also the fact that in the next two verses, Galatians 2:7-8, Paul makes a direct reference to what God did through Peter as something that is relevant to his explanation and therefore mattered to him. These contextual indications, in addition to all of the other evidence, such as the switch in name from Peter to Cephas, support the view that Cephas in Galatians 2 is not Peter. If Cephas was one of the 70 disciples mentioned in Luke 10, as Clement of Alexandria said, then he was influential even though he was not of the original 12. Further, before this Galatians 2:9 meeting, both Paul and Barnabas had already met with the apostolic leadership in the church. We know from Acts 9, which is likely connected with Galatians 1:18, that Paul met with the apostolic leadership in the church well before the Galatians 2:1-10 trip. We also know from Acts 4 that Barnabas met with leaders in the church well before the Galatians 2:1-10 trip to Jerusalem. Acts 4:36-37 tells us that after having sold a field, Barnabas laid the money at the apostles' feet. Since both Paul and Barnabas had already met with the apostolic leadership in the church well before the Galatians 2:1-10 trip, this encounter with James, Cephas, and John was a different meeting in which the two were delegated or approved in a special way for their missionary work. Well, we know from Acts 13:3 that various figures in the church, not just the 12 apostles, had a hand in delegating people for various activities. Thus, it would not be necessary for Peter himself to be present to delegate Paul and Barnabas for such a missionary effort. Hence, there's nothing in any of these texts in Galatians that requires Cephas to be the apostle Peter, but much that militates against that position. Now, identifying where this second trip to Jerusalem, during which Paul meets with James, Cephas, and John, is mentioned in the book of Acts, is very important in our evaluation of whether Cephas in Galatians 2 should be considered to be Peter. That's because, as we learn from Galatians 2:11, it is after this second trip to Jerusalem that Paul is back in Antioch, and Cephas comes there, and the rebuke occurs. To simplify the key points of the chronology, Galatians 2:1-10 describes St. Paul's second trip to Jerusalem after his conversion. Galatians 2:11-14 describes a different event back at Antioch after that trip, during which Paul rebukes Cephas. There are generally two views about where the trip to Jerusalem that Paul describes in Galatians 2:1-10 is mentioned in the book of Acts. The first view is that Galatians 2:1-10 equals Acts 15:2. In Acts 15:1-2, we read that after Paul and Barnabas had a dissension with Judaizers, they and some others were appointed to go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and elders about the question. According to this view, the Galatians 2:1-10 trip to Jerusalem was for the purpose of meeting with the apostles and elders at what became the Council of Jerusalem. This chronology would place St. Paul's rebuke of Cephas at Antioch, which is mentioned in Galatians 2:11-14, after the Council of Jerusalem. That's because the rebuke did not occur in Jerusalem itself, but when Paul was back in Antioch and Cephas came there. By the way, note again that according to Acts 15:2, St. Paul was appointed to go to the apostles in Jerusalem about a controversy. This refutes the heresy of sola scriptura. St. Paul did not practice sola scriptura. Rather, he looked to the authority of the church to resolve the question. So, according to this first view of the chronology, Galatians 2:1-10 connects with Acts 15:2, and they both describe the trip of Paul and Barnabas to Jerusalem for the Council of Jerusalem. Then the Council of Jerusalem takes place during that trip, as recorded in Acts 15:6-29, where St. Peter speaks first on the matter of the Gentiles, and sometime after that, when Paul is back in Antioch and Cephas comes there, the rebuke of Cephas, which is mentioned in Galatians 2:11-14, occurs. The second view, which we believe is the correct view, connects Galatians 2:1-10 with Acts 11:26-30. In Acts 11:26-30, we read that prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. One of them, Agabus, predicted that there would be a great famine. As a result of his prophecy, the disciples determined to send relief or aid to the brothers in Judea. Acts 11:30 says that relief was then sent to the elders in Judea by the hand of Barnabas and Saul, who is St. Paul. And we know that Barnabas and Saul went to Jerusalem on this relief trip because Acts 12:25 says, quote, "And Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had completed their service," end quote. I believe that this view, which connects Galatians 2:1-10 with the trip to Jerusalem recorded in Acts 11:26-30 and Acts 12:25, and not with the trip recorded in Acts 15:2, is the correct view. There are extremely compelling reasons to connect Galatians 2:1-10 with Acts 11:26-30 and not with Acts 15:2. We will see why these points are directly relevant to the Peter-Cephas issue. First, in Galatians 2:2, we read that St. Paul made this second trip to Jerusalem because of a revelation. He doesn't say that it was a revelation given to him, but a revelation. Galatians 2:1-2, quote, "Then after 14 years I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, taking Titus along with me. I went up because of a revelation, end quote. Well, in Acts 11:28-30, we read, quote, and one of them named Agabus stood up and signified by the Spirit that there would be a great famine over all the world, which happened under Claudius. So the disciples determined everyone according to his ability to send relief to the brothers living in Judea, and they did so sending it to the elders by the hand of Barnabas and Saul, end quote. According to Acts 11:28-30, Barnabas and Paul made this trip to Judea, which included Jerusalem, based on a revelation given to the prophet Agabus. That fits precisely with the statement in Galatians 2:2 that Paul made this second trip to Jerusalem because of a revelation. Second, concerning the Galatians 2:1-10 trip, Paul says in Galatians 2:10 that James, Cephas, and John, when they gave him and Barnabas the right hand of communion, quote, only they asked us to remember the poor, the very thing I was eager to do, end quote. This also connects with the account in Acts 11:26-30, which tells us that this trip to Judea, which included Jerusalem, was for famine relief. Acts 11:29-30, quote, said the disciples determined everyone according to his ability to send relief to the brothers living in Judea, and they did so, sending it to the elders by the hand of Barnabas and Saul, end quote. If Paul and Barnabas came to Jerusalem for famine relief, it makes sense that they would be told to remember the poor when they went on their way. Thus, once again, Galatians 2:1-10 connects with Acts 11:26-30. Third, concerning the Galatians 2:1-10 trip, Galatians 2:9 says that when James, Cephas, and John gave Paul and Barnabas the right hand of communion, it was so that they would go to the Gentiles. This fits quite well with Acts 11:26-30, because St. Paul's first formal missionary journey is described in Acts chapter 13, which is after he would have received the right hand of communion to go to the Gentiles in Acts 11:26-30. If, on the other hand, we connect the Galatians 2:1-10 trip with Acts 15:2, it doesn't fit well, for we read in Acts 15:3 that on that trip, Paul and Barnabas were describing in detail the conversion of the Gentiles that they had already witnessed, which, if we connect Acts 15:2 with Galatians 2:1-10, would have been before they even received the right hand of communion to formally go to the Gentiles. So once again, the Galatians 2:1-10 trip is better identified with Acts 11:26-30 than with Acts 15:2. Fourth, in Galatians 2:2, St. Paul says that on this second trip he laid his gospel privately before the ones he met with in Jerusalem to make sure he was not running in vain. That fits with Acts 11:26-30, which mentions Paul and Barnabas coming to Judea, but it does not disclose details of their discussion, as might be expected from a private meeting, which St. Luke, the author of Acts, mentions. On the other hand, Acts 15:5 presents us with a very public dispute in Jerusalem that preceded the council in Jerusalem. Thus, once again, the Galatians 2:1-10 trip, which involved a private discussion, is better identified with Acts 11:26-30 than with Acts 15:2 and following. Fifth, and this is a key point, if Galatians 2:1-10 is identified with Acts 15:2, then the rebuke of Cephas back at Antioch, which is recorded in Galatians 2:11-14, happens after the Council of Jerusalem, when St. Paul has returned to Antioch after the council, and Cephas has joined him there. This presents major problems for that chronology. It would mean that the Council of Jerusalem would have taken place before St. Paul wrote the epistle to the Galatians. St. Paul certainly would have known about the council's decision because he was present for it. In fact, he and Barnabas were two of the people who brought the Council of Jerusalem's decision to those at Antioch, as we read in Acts 15:22-29. Yet, St. Paul makes no mention whatsoever of the Council of Jerusalem or its monumental decision in his epistle to the Galatians, even though that decision bears directly on the controversy he describes in Galatians, and he could have used it to his advantage. That makes no sense unless Galatians and the events it describes happened before the Council of Jerusalem. Paul's failure to mention the Council of Jerusalem in his epistle to the Galatians strongly supports the view that Galatians was written before the council, and therefore that the events Galatians describes, such as the rebuke of Cephas, necessarily happened before the Council of Jerusalem, which is recorded in Acts 15. We will soon see why this is so significant to the present topic. A reasonable dating of these events is that the rebuke of Cephas in Antioch happened around AD 48 or AD 49, with the Council of Jerusalem called in response to it being held not long afterwards, perhaps in AD 49 or 50. Indeed, in recounting the rebuke, Galatians 2:13 describes a scene at Antioch as a result of Cephas and the Judaizers, in which an entire group of people refused to eat with Gentiles who did not observe the Mosaic law. Galatians 2:13, quote, "And the rest of the Judeans acted hypocritically along with him," that is Cephas, "so that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy," end quote. Is it likely that such a huge controversy on the matter of eating with the Gentiles, entangling this many people, would have taken place in Antioch after the church had pronounced its decision on how to handle the Gentiles at the Council of Jerusalem, and specifically sent that decision to Antioch? No. Once again, this strongly supports the position that the rebuke of Cephas, as well as the writing of the epistle to the Galatians, happened before the Council of Jerusalem. Indeed, it makes complete sense that the council specifically sent its decision to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas, because the major incident in Antioch that occurred before the council, which involved Paul and Barnabas and Paul's rebuke of Cephas, was the reason the Council of Jerusalem met. The view that St. Paul wrote Galatians before the council and that the events recorded in Galatians happened before the council fits extremely well with the information in Acts. It also makes it almost certain that the Cephas of Galatians 2 was not the Apostle Peter, as we will see. For the sake of clarity and simplicity, let's quickly summarize some of the key points of the chronology we are presenting. 1. Paul does not mention the Council of Jerusalem in Galatians because Galatians was written before the council, and therefore the events Galatians describes, including the rebuke of Cephas, happened before the council. 2. Galatians 2:1-10, which according to Galatians is Paul's second trip to Jerusalem after his conversion, should be connected with Acts 11:26-30 for various persuasive reasons, and Acts 11:26-30 is before the Council of Jerusalem, which is recorded in Acts 15. 3. We know that following this second trip to Jerusalem, that is, following Acts 11:26-30, Paul and Barnabas returned to Antioch at least two more times before the council. See Acts 13:1 and Acts 14:26. Since the rebuke of Cephas happens when Paul is back at Antioch after the second trip to Jerusalem, that is, after Acts 11:26-30, and it happened before the Council of Jerusalem in Acts 15, it makes sense that the rebuke of Cephas happened when Paul was back at Antioch, either in Acts 13:1 or in Acts 14:26, with the incident probably occurring when Paul was back in Antioch, as recorded in Acts 14:26. That would put the incident before, and probably shortly before, the Council of Jerusalem, which is recorded in Acts 15. 4. The Acts 15:2 trip of Paul and Barnabas to Jerusalem was thus Paul's third trip to Jerusalem after his conversion, a trip that is not recorded in Galatians because Galatians was written before the trip occurred. This Acts 15:2 trip of Paul and Barnabas for the Council of Jerusalem in order to resolve the dispute with Judaizers that broke out in Antioch was therefore after the rebuke of Cephas in Antioch. Indeed, the Acts 15:2 trip was almost certainly taken by Paul and Barnabas in direct response to Paul's rebuke of Cephas and the surrounding controversy in Antioch. Notice how well this fits with the scriptural data in Acts 15:1-2, which tells us the reason that Paul and Barnabas came to Jerusalem on this occasion. Acts 15:1-2, quote, "But some men came down from Judea into Antioch," see Acts 14:26, "and were teaching the brothers, 'Unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved.' And after Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and debate with them, Paul and Barnabas and some of the others were appointed to go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and the elders about this question," end quote. This corresponds precisely to the chronology we are presenting. Acts 15:1-2 says that as a result of Judaizers who came from Judea into Antioch, matching Galatians 2:11-12, there was no small dissension and debate in Antioch, matching Galatians 2:11-14. That no small dissension and debate with the Judaizers in Antioch, we are contending, is the incident described in Galatians 2:11-14, which included the public rebuke of Cephas by Paul. As a consequence of that incident in Antioch, Paul and Barnabas were appointed to go to Jerusalem to the apostles to have the controversy with the Judaizers resolved. One might raise a small objection by pointing out that here in Acts 15:2 it says that Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and debate with them, but in Galatians 2:13 it says that even Barnabas was led astray by those Judaizers. But that can be easily explained. Barnabas might have disputed with the Judaizers at first and then been led astray, only to be recalled to the correct practice by Paul, or after Paul rebuked Cephas, Barnabas could have joined Paul's side in the dispute against the Judaizers. While this slight variation between Luke's account in Acts and Paul's account in Galatians can be explained rather easily, The alternative view of the chronology, namely that this Acts 15:2 trip was not in response to the rebuke of Cephas at Antioch, but before it, cannot be cogently explained. For if you say that this Acts 15:2 trip to Jerusalem was not in response to the rebuke of Cephas and the surrounding controversy with the Judaizers in Antioch, even though the passage tells us that Paul and Barnabas made this trip after a dispute at Antioch with Judaizers, then you must posit a huge dispute at Antioch involving Judaizers before the Council of Jerusalem, and then another separate huge dispute at Antioch involving Judaizers after the council, during which Paul rebuked Cephas. You must also hold that both disputes, that is, the one before the council and the one after the council, involved Paul and Barnabas, and were instigated by men coming from Judea into Antioch. That is extremely unlikely. Thus, the statement in Acts 15:2 that Paul and Barnabas made this trip to Jerusalem in response to a major dispute with Judaizers in Antioch provides more powerful support for the chronology we have presented, namely, that Paul and Barnabas are back at Antioch in Acts 13:1 or in Acts 14:26, and the huge controversy with the Judaizers, including the public rebuke of Cephas, happens there before the Council of Jerusalem. As a result of that incident in Antioch, Paul and Barnabas are appointed to go to Jerusalem to the apostles to settle the issue, as we read in Acts 15:1-2. Now here's why all of this makes it almost 100% certain that the Cephas of Galatians 2:11-14 was not the Apostle Peter. Acts 15:1 describes those who caused the controversy at Antioch as, quote, some men. No names are given. But if Cephas is the Apostle Peter, and if Cephas was openly Judaizing in Antioch before the Council of Jerusalem, then Peter himself, the chief apostle, was allied with or among the men causing the controversy and the problem at Antioch. Is it likely that St. Luke, the author of Acts, would not have mentioned that Peter himself was involved in this major dispute, but instead just simply referred to the troublemakers as some men? No, it's not, especially when Luke mentions Peter many times in Acts, and describes his activity in detail, including in the very same chapter, Acts 15. Luke also explicitly mentions that Paul and Barnabas were involved in this dispute at Antioch. So if Peter had been involved in the dispute, it makes sense that Luke's account would have mentioned that. To put it another way, we have presented an overwhelming case that the dissension at Antioch that is described in Acts 15:2 is another account of the dissension at Antioch that is described in Galatians 2:11-14. And in Acts 15:1-2, Luke says nothing whatsoever about Peter being involved in the dispute at Antioch, even though he speaks of Peter in detail in the same chapter with regard to the council. That strongly favors the position that Peter was not involved in the dispute at Antioch, whose instigators Luke characterizes as some men. Second, and more powerfully, Acts 15:2 tells us that as a result of the controversy with Judaizers at Antioch, quote, Paul and Barnabas and some of the others were appointed to go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and the elders about this question, end quote. Think about this carefully. If Cephas was the apostle Peter, then Peter was involved in causing the controversy at Antioch. So why would Paul and Barnabas need to leave Antioch and go to Jerusalem to see the apostles to resolve the question when the chief apostle was already in Antioch? It doesn't make sense. In other words, the apostle Peter was supposedly causing the problem at Antioch, so Paul and Barnabas were appointed to go to Jerusalem to see Peter and the apostles to resolve it. It doesn't make sense. This makes it almost 100% certain that Cephas in Galatians 2 was not Peter. Moreover, consider how incongruous the entire scene at the Council of Jerusalem in Acts 15 would have been if the Cephas of Galatians 2 were Peter in this scenario. Peter was supposedly recently involved in creating the problem on the Gentile issue at Antioch, for which he was publicly rebuked by St. Paul. Then Paul and Barnabas are appointed to go to the apostles at Jerusalem to get the answer. Where? Guess who? Peter himself speaks first on the whole matter to give the answer, causes the whole assembly to fall silent, and he references God's choice of his mouth in regard to the Gentiles. None of that fits with the position that Peter was involved with the problem at Antioch. When you combine all of these points with one, the shift in reference in the manuscripts from Petros to Cephas starting in Galatians 2:9, 2, the contextual indications, 3, the evidence from the early church that the Cephas of Galatians 2:11 was not St. Peter, and 4, St. Peter's behavior in the Acts of the Apostles, which is not at all consistent with compromising with the Judaizers. Indeed, in Acts 11, he did the opposite of what Cephas in Galatians 2 does. The conclusion that follows is that the Cephas of Galatians 2 was not St. Peter. Further, this video has demonstrated that the view which holds that Cephas in Galatians 2 was St. Peter, which we consider wrong, is nothing more than a supposition. It cannot be proven. It therefore cannot be used as the basis for any anti-papal theological conclusion, and as we've shown, there is an extremely strong argument against it. The fact that so many have concluded, we believe wrongly, that St. Peter is the person described in Galatians 2:11-14 is, in our view, an example of how God allows people to adopt erroneous theological positions. That's why one must never deviate from the clear testimony of Scripture and the Church on the papacy or another matter, just because he or she might have an unanswered question, or expect something to have been put differently or more clearly. There is always an answer that is perfectly consistent with the one true Christian faith, that is, the traditional Catholic faith, outside of which there is no salvation, and the data of Scripture.